Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review was heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower, when we return right after this message. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who can't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, you know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. And while we're talking about lawyer incompetence, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about law school students. He said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students, most, over half, graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's step one. It's free. Doesn't cost you a dime. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School, and it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. So you don't have to come to school, you can do it at home. And if you're online, you can go to my website, it's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of the ancient Parthian Empire. We'll talk about where those Parthians came from. They're part of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. You remember that Jesus sent his apostles, his disciples, out to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He didn't send them to the Chinese, Japanese, to the Indians. He sent them to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And, of course, these Israelites have been called the lost tribes of Israel. They've been lost in history. They've been lost from secular history. But history is written by the victors. Just like the Civil War, history is written by the Yankees in the North, not the defeated rebels in the South. That doesn't mean that there aren't some histories out there about the defeated rebels in the South, but those are not the histories that are promulgated in our public schools. So your view of the Civil War is skewered. In our modern socialist, communist America, we have a different view of the Revolutionary War and of the history of the United States than we would have had had that history been written from the perspective of Americans. American history. American heroes. Our Constitution and Bill of Rights. It's always been that way. The history of the world is written by the Romans and the Greeks, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. These ancient pagan empires, in the final analysis, won the hearts and minds of the people of the world. The world is a pagan environment. It's an anti-God, anti-Christian, anti-biblical world that you live in. And particularly so in the United States. Now, in the Muslim world, you can understand the law, the logic behind it. The logic behind it in the Muslim world is that why would we want to promote a competing religion, a competing philosophy? But in the United States, where we're the bastion of Christian philosophy, why would you ban your chief religious textbook, the Bible, from your public schools and your public institutions? You can rest assured that the Quran is not banned from the government or banned from the school system of Iran. It will shortly be banned from the school system of Iraq. I'm pretty sure of that, as long as we have anything to say about it. And that's why the Muslims hate us, because we're trying to interfere with their religion, their culture, their history. And after all, that's what wars are all about. A war, in the final analysis, is a battle for your mind. And that's what the game is all about. The battle is a battle for your mind, for your beliefs, for your loyalty. And then, with that in hand, we can put our hands into your pocket and take your taxes and your donations. Ultimately, as old Dan Rather would say, follow the money. And in America, you just follow the money, and you'll find that it leads to Jerry Falwell, Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, Jim Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, Pat Roberts. And these aren't small businesses. And these Christian, religious businesses support communism, socialism, and the New World Order. They're anti-scriptural, they're anti-biblical, and they're anti-God. Well, they're the anti-God of the Bible. They're not anti-God. They are the forces of the anti-God of the Scripture. They're not for the God of Moses, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, this fellow, Stephen Collins, is a rare breed. He's written a history book of the ancient historical origins of the tribes of Israel and where they migrated and where they went to and where they are today. He's in the process of writing a series of 6 books. He's completed 4. This is the 3rd book, the book on Parthia, the ancient superpower. Now, if there was a superpower equal to Rome that defeated Rome in every major war for 500 years, maintained their independence, and then ultimately collapsed, and then disappeared from the world scene, you'd think that a history of a civilization like that, you know, at least equal to or greater than Egypt, Greece, Rome, Babylon, Assyria, would be mentioned from time to time in secular history today. Now, you know, I'm 65 years old and I've never read about Parthia. I never heard the name Parthia or Scythia. Well, I probably heard the names, you know, passing somewhere, but I didn't know anything about this. I went to the public school. I got my high school equivalency test. I spent 12 years in the public school system. And then I had to spend the next 50 years unlearning the false knowledge that I had received. And I'm still doing that today. The lies, the false information that's been passed out through our civilization. You know, like Christmas and Santa Claus comes down the chimney. You know, little things like that. I learned that in Sunday school and church, didn't you? Well, Stephen Collins has written a dynamite book called Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower. You can get a copy of it. Let's see, it's BibleBlessings.com. And that's their email address. Let me get over here to the first page. BibleBlessings.net. BibleBlessings.net. And the company that prints it is called Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. I'll give you that address a couple of more times as we progress. Now, we were up to the China connection. Now, the Chinese have written some history in the world, too. We don't pay much attention to Chinese history or Chinese information here in the West. Chinese medicine, Chinese politics, Chinese religion, Chinese history. We don't, you know, we Western people over here know more than the Chinese. We're smarter than they are. Of course, we've been around about 200 years, and they've been around for about 4,000, but then, you know, what could the Chinese know? Well, surprisingly, the Chinese have been around for 4,000 years, and they've been keeping track of what's been going on in the world. So when you want to validate something, you go to China, and sure enough, you can find out that Marco Polo went to China, and the Chinese wrote about it. So you can verify Marco Polo's trip to China, because they had something to say about it. Well, you can also verify the Parthian Empire and quite a bit about them by going to China. Now, China, Collins goes on to tell us, China was impressed that Parthia had sent 20,000 cavalry simply to meet and escort the Chinese delegation, and they recorded that fact for posterity. And it's noteworthy that China mentions that Parthia did conduct commerce by way of ships, as well as by way of land routes. One Chinese account implies that both Parthia and China were aware of North America. And it states, quote, from, and these words are a little difficult for me to pronounce, but I'll kind of muddle through it. It's from Tiao Chi, which is called Chaldea. By water, you may go west over 100 days to come near the place where the sun sets. And they say, in the ninth year of Yang Yan of Ho Ti, in 97 A.D., the general Pan Chao sent Can Ying as an ambassador to the Tats in Syria, who arrived in Tao Chi on the coast of the Great Sea. When about to take his passage across the sea, the sailors of the western frontier of Parthia told Can Ying, the sea is vast and great. With favorable winds, it is possible to cross within 3 months. But if you meet slow winds, it may take you 2 years. Now, this account indicates that the Chinese learned from the Parthians about a place where the sun sets, which was far to the west across the Great Sea. It indicates a voyage of at least 100 days was necessary to cross the Great Sea to a landfall on the western side. The Great Sea must be the Atlantic Ocean, as it would not take 3 months to 2 years to cross the Mediterranean Sea. However, if a voyage left from the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea on the shores of Syria, a problem exists. You see, that was Roman territory, and except for a few years, from 40 to 37 B.C., when Syria and Palestine were subject to Parthia, it seems highly unlikely that Parthian vessels ever departed westward from the coast of Syria. However, the Chinese ambassador, Can Ying, considered embarking on a Parthian vessel while he was in Tiao Chi, Chaldea, and Chaldea was in Mesopotamia, and the Persian Gulf was a Parthian seacoast. The voyage to the land far to the west across the Great Sea more likely began in the Persian Gulf. This would also account for the voyage taking so long, as it would have to almost circumnavigate Africa before heading across the Atlantic Ocean to the Americas. Now, the fact that Parthian sailors told the Chinese that an area of slow winds could be encountered, which would greatly prolong the voyage, adds to the credibility of this account. There's an area known as the doldrums in the Atlantic in which the winds rarely blow. Mariners who venture into this area with ships dependent on wind power could get marooned for a very long time as they waited for ocean currents to drift them into the regions where the winds would again be encountered. How would Parthian mariners know about sea conditions in the Atlantic unless they had been there? Well, there's an obvious answer. Parthia had extensive trade relations with the Romans during their period of détente. During these times, the Parthian merchant class imported metals and various manufactured items from Rome in exchange for textiles and spices supplied by the Parthians from sources as far east as China. And as evidence for the far-ranging trade between the Roman and Parthian empires, one Parthian coin was unearthed in the British Isles. And the above indicates that the Parthians were capitalists who took advantage of their strategic position as geographic middlemen between the Roman world and the Orient. And during peaceful periods between Rome and Parthia, the trading vessels of each empire would have been welcome in each other's home ports. At the very least, Parthians accompanying Parthian cargo shipments likely sailed on Roman ships to Roman ports of call in Spain and the British Isles. Parthians would have learned about the dangers of the doldrums during such voyages. And the Parthians were hardly barbarians when it came to scientific pursuits. It is known that their Scythian kinsmen were miners and expert artisans in gold artwork. The Parthians had an advanced military technology at the time of the First Parthian-Roman War, better bows, more protective body armor and such. And there's one more piece of evidence that will surprise modern readers. The Parthians had developed electricity. In a 1996 issue of Nexus magazine revealed, quote, Wilhelm Koenig, the director of the Baghdad Museum, reported the discovery of an electric battery 2,000 years old. You've not heard about this sensational discovery. Why? Well, we can tell you why. It did not fit in with the established viewpoint. Most archaeologists do not want to know about it, and they hoped it would go away. But Koenig's electric battery did not go away. In fact, a lot more of these batteries have been found in Parthian settlements near Baghdad. Because a lot of these ancient Parthian batteries were found, there was a widespread use for them in ancient Parthia. This article explained the ancient batteries were pottery jars holding an acidic solution with metallic elements. Since each battery could only generate 1.5 volts of current, it was deduced that these ancient people must have discovered how to link up several batteries in series to produce a higher voltage. One suggested use of electricity in Parthia was for electroplating. The economic advantages of electroplating common objects with gold exterior, for instance, are obvious. One could command a much higher price for an object, or create a much more impressive collection to show off to others. If you could deceive buyers or viewers into thinking or believing that they were looking at a solid gold object instead of a gold-plated one, these ancient Parthian batteries are occasionally shown on cable television documentaries. These ancient batteries have also been mentioned or pictured in other books. Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods tells us, quote, electric dry batteries which work on galvanic principles are on display in the Baghdad Museum. A photograph of an ancient Parthian battery appears in von Däniken's book In Search of Ancient Gods. It's also been proposed that the Parthians used the batteries for medicinal purposes. Nexus magazine went on to say, quote, Paul T. Kaiser of the University of Alberta in Canada has an alternative suggestion, writing in the prestigious Archaeological Journal of Near East Studies. He claims that these batteries were analgesics and that they have been used to apply electric shock to a patient's stricken parts, unquote. Analgesic treatments for relieving pain would always be in demand in any society. given the fact that Parthia's many wars with Rome produced many wounded and pain-ridden soldiers, small portable batteries may have been used to provide a measure of pain relief for battlefield injuries. Seleucia was a city in the Parthian Empire which was more than once caught in the crossfire of Roman-Parthian wars, supporting the proposed use of the batteries for medicinal purposes. Is, of course, the fact that bronze and iron needles were found alongside the battery devices found in Seleucia. These needles may have been used for acupuncture. Now, the Parthians traded with the Chinese so that they could have easily become acquainted with the art of acupuncture, which is a Chinese procedure that dates back many thousands of years. Paul Kaiser's article in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies states the following. He said, the Parthian galvanic batteries, electric batteries, have been known for some 50 years, but have never been scientifically published, and they have heretofore seemed embarrassingly out of the context and have received very little scientific treatment. The usual hypothesis is that the purpose of the cells was electroplating, but I argue that this is impossible. Rather, I suggest a purpose as a local analgesic, such an application is supported by the modern clinical practice of transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, unquote. In modern medical usage, a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation device is called a TENS unit today. Whatever the purpose served by these ancient Parthian electrical devices, they are an amazing find. And why has the truth about them been ignored, or in fact even hidden? Nexus Magazine offers this apt explanation. Quote, it was too much for the establishment. It did not fit in with the usual concepts of the development of Homo sapiens and evolutionary philosophy. The brilliant generation of modern man, which had slowly evolved from the primitive ape man to our sophisticated scientific society today. The Parthian batteries were before their time and were best forgotten. Unquote. Now, the blind adherence of the establishment to the theory of evolution has led to the suppression of truth about the ancient world whenever the facts do not support the theory of evolution. Not only has the existence of the ancient Israelite empires been censored from history texts, well, why did the establishment suppress the knowledge that the ancient Parthians had electric batteries more than two millennia ago? Well, their existence is powerful evidence against the theory of evolution, and rather than abandon their flawed theory of evolution, it was easier to go into denial about the truths of the ancient world. However, you, the reader, are now going to learn those truths. Who in Parthian society invented and controlled access to the electric batteries? Well, this author suggests it was the Magi, Parthia's priestly class, some of whom visited the Christ child, if you'll remember, in the early chapters of the New Testament. The terms magic and magician are based on the Persian Parthian word Magi. Difficult-to-be-understood technologies are often referred to as magic. Electroplating, common objects to look like golden ones, or relieving pain with mysterious methods like electricity would have been seen as magic. Indeed, the private possession of such knowledge would have helped to preserve the influence and special status of the Magi, because the term magic comes directly from the Parthian Magi, and because these ancient batteries date to the Parthian period, the Magi were the likely inventors, custodians, of this Parthian battery. Concerning Parthia's religion, we know that their empire contained sun worshippers and other pagan religions, as discussed earlier. Judaism was common in Parthia, and Christianity had many adherents in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. Indeed, Rawlinson wrote that Christianity penetrated the Parthian provinces to a considerable extent, and in one Parthian country, it seems to have become the state religion, and the kings of Osirhoene are thought to have been Christians from the time of the Antonians, if not from that of our Lord, the time of Christ, and a flourishing church was certainly established at Edessa before the end of the 2nd century. And Parthia allowed considerable freedom of religion for its subjects, a tolerant attitude not typical of the ancient world's empires. And Rawlinson adds this. He said the Parthians had many liberal usages which employ a fairly advanced civilization. In political matters, they seem to have been free from the narrowness which generally characterizes barbarous nations. They behaved well to prisoners, admitted foreigners freely to offices of high trust, and gave an asylum to refugees. And they were scrupulous observers of their pledged word and eminently faithful to their treaty obligations. Unquote. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. If you can learn rule one, you can win about 86% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Listen to what the judges have to say. Judges, in their opinions in various cases about keeping quiet in face of police interrogation and indeed in many cases police intimidation. The first judge put it this way in United States versus Dickerson. He said, quote, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" The second judge said in Belknap versus U.S. as it relates to this subject, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." The third judge said this, speaking about taxes, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the far-sighted," in Marchetti versus United States. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call 417-273-4967, that's the law school, and be sure to ask for the free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website, it's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email while you're there, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, do it right now before you forget. And that email address, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, let me give a plug here for the book. It's called Parthia, the Ancient, or the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, written by a fellow by the name of Stephen M. Collins. He lives up in Sioux City. Is it Sioux City? No, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's published by Bible Blessings. You can go to their website. It's BibleBlessings.net. Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan 48068. I rate this about a 1 in 100 book. There may be other books out there on ancient history, and indeed there are, and they're good reading, but this one is so unique. Except for some 100, 200-year-old texts written by Rawlinson and others, it isn't that Parthia wasn't written about. It's been written about in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. It's in our modern 20th century, in the period that we call the dumbing down of America, that Parthia and their technological achievements have been totally banished from our knowledge, from our textbooks. And this, of course, comes from our colleges and universities. They decide what we should and shouldn't know, what we should and shouldn't believe. And of course, we work very hard to educate our children, don't we, in these same universities, which, as Charlotte Isherby points out, is simply the dumbing down of America. He goes on to say that Parthia's empire was based on a feudal system that foreshadowed the feudal system of medieval Europe, a system patterned after the biblical system that we see that God gave to Moses. The Parthians elected their monarchs by way of a bicameral body composed of the royalty, the priestly tribe, and the nobility. They were capitalists who traded widely with other nations and even with their enemies when possible. The Parthians were good hosts to large numbers of Jews within their borders and even allowed home rule privileges to some nations and cities in their empire. There were many adherents of Judaism and Christianity in the Parthian Empire, and their empire was known for many of the commendable traits of the Judeo-Christian ethic, as we call it today. In contrast, the Romans had a religion of superstitious polytheism, launched many years of aggression to exalt the ignominia of its emperors and commanders, enslaved other nations with tight controls, oppressed Jews, persecuted Christians, regularly violated treaties. Same thing we see from communists today. One of the clearest indicators of Rome's moral depravity was its love for gladiatorial games. And the reader is urged to look up gladiator in the encyclopedia for a fuller accounting of Rome's degenerate pastime. Readers who saw the movie Gladiator, released in the spring of 2000, saw a graphic portrayal of this grisly activity. The Encyclopedia Britannica notes that many Roman emperors sponsored these public murders, and it states, quote, Julius Caesar engaged such extravagant numbers that the Senate imposed a certain limit. Claudius was devoted to this pastime. Under Nero, senators and even well-born women appeared as combatants. Even the emperor Titus ordered a show which lasted 100 days. Domitian, at the Saturnalia of 90 AD, arranged a battle between dwarfs and women. The Encyclopedia Americana makes this observation about the character of Rome's appetite for public murder as a sport. Thousands of gladiators died annually in amphitheaters of the Roman Empire. Gladiatorial combat was probably the cruelest sport ever widely accepted in an advanced civilization. The Romans possessed great engineering skills in designing the buildings and roads, aqueducts, etc., surviving to this day. And surviving Roman ruins attest to the remarkable Roman skills in such construction projects. Rome also was highly skilled in the art of war. However, Rome's character was deeply flawed. The long-standing popularity of the gladiatorial contest testifies to Rome's barbaric cruelty and bloodlust. Given the fact that watching mass public murders was a favorite sport of Rome's leading leaders and citizens for centuries, Rome's society and culture exhibited a strong sociopathic aspect for much of its existence. If the leaders and citizens of any modern nation enjoyed public mass murder spectacles as one of their major national sports, would we call that nation civilized? Obviously, we would not. And modern societies would label such a practice as unspeakably degenerate and depraved. Yet history texts paradoxically and routinely describe the degenerate Romans as civilized, and they called the Parthians and other rivals of Rome barbarians. By any standard of comparison, which empire was civilized and which was barbaric, it was far more preferable to live under Parthian rule than under Roman rule, as the nations caught between the two empires regularly affirmed. The answer is obvious. The Parthian Empire was far more tolerant, far more humane, and far more civilized than the Roman Empire. And there's also a myth that Rome was the custodian and preserver of civilized knowledge, holding back the Dark Ages until the barbarians sacked Rome. The reverse is true. Rome was largely responsible for the Dark Ages because it was the great destroyer of civilized knowledge. Now consider the following quote by René Neuberger. He said, the Roman ruthlessness was an integral part of the wave of wanton destruction that struck the library of Carthage in 146 BC, reducing its irreplaceable 500,000 volumes to ashes. The most devastating blow, however, was struck by Julius Caesar when he burned the Athenaeum of Alexandria, destroying 700,000 of the most valued scientific works of the classical world at that time. Unquote. Rome destroyed the great libraries that contained the world's historical and scientific knowledge. The Carthaginian library surely had the entire history of the Phoenician Empire, which had founded Carthage. This would have included many volumes on Israelite history. It also contained the nautical technologies and the global maps that had been painstakingly developed over the centuries by Phoenician and Carthaginian mariners. If Carthage's library had survived, a modern man would have realized that the ancient Phoenicians and Carthaginians knew that the earth was round at least 1,000 years prior to the Greco-Romans. And who knows what technical knowledge was contained in Alexandria's library that had to be relearned when mankind emerged from the Dark Ages. Rome was too brutish to appreciate the priceless knowledge of other civilizations, and so they destroyed it. The modern Western world thinks its societies are based on the Greco-Roman institutions, and students are force-fed the history of Rome, while the extensive history of the Parthian Empire is almost totally suppressed. Now, any honest comparison indicates that the governmental and societal structure of medieval Europe and the modern world today have much more in common with the institutions and practices of the Parthian Empire than those of the Roman Empire, as will be seen in the next book. The modern world has been taught a major historical error. Now, even though European culture and the modern Western world developed in the geographical region of the old Roman Empire, its social and political institutions are firmly rooted in the heritage of Parthia. And the next book in this series will explain how all of this happened. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime, and what should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, and rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything, and then shut up. That's rule one, and after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call me at the law school. That's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures also available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, just go to the website, George Gordon. GeorgeGordon.org. That's GeorgeGordon.org. Click on the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. You ought to do that right now before you forget. Remember that number, 417-273-4967. Well, how did it get this way? How did the Parthian Empire begin? To look into the beginnings of Parthia, many readers ask the question, who or what was Parthia? It's a testimony to the woeful lack of historical knowledge in the modern world. And this question could even be asked, or that this question should even be asked. Parthia was a vast ancient empire which ruled in Asia at the time at the same time that the Roman Empire ruled over the Mediterranean region. And although Rome launched many wars of imperial aggression against Parthia, none of those wars succeeded in their aims of subjugating these people, the Parthians. Conversely, Parthia administered many crushing military defeats to the Roman armies as these two ancient superpowers opposed each other for centuries. And in spite of the fact that such and much is known about Parthia's history, it's also totally ignored in history textbooks today. How accurate a picture of ancient history would we have if textbooks dwelled extensively on Parthia's empire and then neglected to mention Rome? It would yield a very distorted view of ancient history. And yet we now have an equally distorted view of world history today as a result of Parthia's omission from texts on ancient history. Charlotte Isherby calls this the deliberate dumbing down of America. The famous 19th century historian George Rawlinson wrote two books extensively documenting the history of the Parthian Empire. They were entitled Parthia and the Sixth Great Oriental Monarchy. The Greco-Roman classical writers recorded a voluminous amount of information about Parthia, and Rawlinson wrote about the defective view of history which resulted from ignoring Parthia's major role in world history. And he introduces the Sixth Great Oriental Monarchy with these words. He said, "The picture of the world during the Roman period that is put before students in histories of Rome was defective, not to say false, in its omission to recognize the real position of Parthia as a counterpoise to the power of Rome, a rival state dividing with Rome the attention of mankind and the sovereignty of the known earth. Writers of Roman history have been too much in the habit of representing Rome as a universal monarchy, a power unchecked, having no other limits than those of the civilized world. The truth seems to be that, from the first to the last, there was always in the world a second power, civilized or semi-civilized, which in a true sense balanced Rome, acted as a counterpoise and a check, and this power for nearly three centuries, from B.C. 64 to A.D. 225, was Parthia." Now, the fact that Rome had equal rivals in the ancient world will surprise many readers. In this chapter and the following chapter will attempt to restore a balanced perspective on ancient history by a thorough discussion of the origins of history of this ancient superpower called Parthia. This abysmal lack of information on Parthia results from the fact that history has been taught almost exclusively from an ethnocentric Greco-Roman perspective. The preoccupation with Greco-Roman history has led to major misunderstandings about the realities of the ancient world and in the previous books of this series in Israelite history. We learned that widespread ignorance about Phoenician and Carthaginian history has led to modern man's unawareness of the role of North America in ancient history. And indeed, not just North America, but South America as well. Brazil was called Iron Land. The very word Brazil means iron land. This is where the ancient world came to get their iron ore. This was due to the fact that the Phoenician and Carthaginian fleets controlled Gibraltar and for almost a millennium denied the Greco-Romans any maritime access to lands beyond the Mediterranean Sea. And as a result, Greece and Rome were far less advanced than the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians in nautical skills and in understanding world geography. And also we learned in a previous book that the Scythians, the Saki, were a civilized people and that their power was so great that they devastated the Assyrian Empire and twice defeated the Persian Empire. And yet you read almost nothing about them in history texts today. And we shall now learn that modern man's neglect of Parthian history has led to more gross misunderstandings about the ancient world. And these misunderstandings affect us today. And you're going to see in the fourth book of this series how our misunderstandings about ancient history distort our perceptions of what is really happening in today's world events. Now let's take a look at the Hebrew Israelite origins of Parthia. Who were these people called the Parthians? Well, there's no record of their presence in Asia at all until the Persians refer to them in the 6th century BC. And there's no mention of them in the Old Testament or in the Assyrian inscriptions or in the Zend-Avesta. The Persians called them the Partheva, and they named them as a subject people involved in a revolt in 521 BC. Herodias mentions the Parthians as being one of the subject nations in the Medo-Persian army, which attacked Greece under Xerxes, the Persian king. Herodias also mentions that the Parthians were subjects of King Darius and that they lived in an adjoining province in some of the, or to some of the Sacchi. Now, those who have read the previous book in this series know that the Sacchi were the Scythians named after Isaac, the Israelite patriarch mentioned in the Bible. The Parthian homeland was located southeast of the Caspian Sea. The Parthians are clearly identified by historians as having a common origin with the Scythians. Rawlinson states, quote, that there was a strong conviction on the part of those who came in contact with the Parthians that they were Scyths, and adds that the Scythic character of the Parthians is asserted in the strongest terms by the ancient writers. And Rawlinson cites the classical historians Strabo, Justin, and Arrian in stating, quote, the manners of the Parthians had, they tell us, much that was Scythic in them. Their language was half Scythic, half Median. They armed themselves in the Scythic fashion. They were Scyths in descent, in habits, and in character. The Scythian origin of the Parthians is further confirmed by the fact that many times in their history, the Parthians sought the aid of the Scythians in various wars. Ousted Parthian kings sometimes sought asylum in Scythia. This recurrent Parthian reliance on the Sacchi tribes of Scythia in times of trouble confirms that the Parthians and the Scythians were natural allies. And there is a record from Diodorus, a Greek historian of the 1st century BC, that the Parthians had, quote, passed from the dominion of the Assyrians to that of the Medes to a similar position under the Persians. Rawlinson also notes concerning the Parthians that it was believed that their name meant exiles. Hence, it was necessary to suppose that they had migrated into their country from some portion of Scythia. Now, the previous book documented that the Assyrians exiled two waves of Israelite captives into Asia, and that some of them were located in the cities of the Medes. After the fall of Assyria's empire, it is logical that some Asian Israelites would come under the dominion of the Medes and the Persians. The above evidence that Parthia's language was half Median indicates that the Parthians had lived in very close proximity to the Medes for a considerable length of time. Some of Israel's exiles were placed in the cities of the Medes. We see that in 2 Kings 17, verse 6, confirming that many Israelites would have lived among the Medes and become familiar with the Medes language. Now, the last chapter of the previous book provided abundant evidence that the Sacchi, or the Scythians, were relocated members of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, since ancient historians affirm the Parthians were kinsmen of the Sacchi, the Scythians, and since there is no record of any Parthians being in Asia until after the Israelites were placed there, it is evident that the Parthians were also part of the 10 tribes of Israel. The fact that ancient writers regarded them as a nation of exiles supports this identification, and the 10 tribes of Israel in their Asian locations were, indeed, there as exiles from Palestine. Rawlinson cites an account of ancient historian Diodorus that the Parthians revolted from the Medes and placed themselves under Scythian protection. This confirms that from the time of their first efforts to gain independence, the Parthians looked to the Scythians as their natural protectors and liberators. The Encyclopaedia Britannica records that the alphabets in use in Persia, at least from the time of the Arsacid dynasty onwards, are based upon the Aramaic. The earliest records of Aramaic go back to about 800 BC and were found in northern Syria. Other developments of Aramaic are modern Square Hebrew. The Arsacid dynasty refers to the Parthian kings that the Parthians utilized an Aramaic alphabet. A Semitic alphabet related to Hebrew confirms that the Parthians originated in the region of Syria and Palestine where the Aramaic language developed. Their use of a Semitic alphabet clearly indicates that the Parthians had a Semitic racial and linguistic origin. Also, since ancient historians strongly maintain that the Parthians were a Scythian people, the Semitic nature of Parthia's language reinforces the Semitic origin of the Scythians, and that the Parthian language was related to the Hebrew language, and it strongly indicates that the Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel who had been relocated into Media and other Asian regions. What little is preserved of the Parthian language confirms a Semitic origin for the Parthians, and Rawlinson states that the Parthian word for city was Karta, or Kerta, spelled K-A-R-T-A or K-E-R-T-A. Now, in the previous book, the Semitic Israelite origin of Carthage was discussed, and it was noted that the original Semitic name of Carthage was Kerjath. The Semitic name of Carthage is also rendered as Kart, K-A-R-T, meaning new city. Now, the Semitic origin of Carthage is well known, and both the Carthaginians and the Parthians used the word Kart for city, indicating that they both shared a common Semitic origin. And that common origin was in the Old Kingdom of Israel called Phoenicia by the Greeks. Now, in the next chapter, we'll examine the role of the Parthian Magi, an influential portion of Parthia's ruling classes. An early Carthaginian ruler was named Mago, again indicating a common linguistic heritage with the Parthians. A modern website on Parthia notes the following about the Parthian language. It says, "The Parthians used the Aramaic alphabet for writing." This is another example, or another example is the Aramaic title M-L-K-Y-N, or M-L-K, which equals King of Kings. And they also use the word B-R-Y, which equals My Son in Aramaic. The Parthian Aramaic word for king, M-L-K, is also the Hebrew word for king, and it appears over 2,500 times in the Hebrew Bible. The word B-R-Y is an obvious cognate word to the Hebrew word B-R or B-A-R, which also is translated son in the Bible. The Aramaic Parthian or Semitic Parthian linguistic link could just as easily be called a Hebrew Parthian link, but establishment sources are not likely to acknowledge that connection, because doing so would lead to the inescapable racial ethnic link between the Parthians and the tribes of Israel who had been transplanted into Asia. A prominent family of Parthians was called the Surin family, and one of their hereditary rights was to crown Parthian kings. The word Surin, S-U-R-E-N, and it also appears as Surina or Surinius, and it's a Hebrew composite word. The Hebrew word S-U-R includes the meaning reign or make princes, and the Hebrew word N, rendered A-Y-I-N, means I, sight or presence. The Parthian name Surin is Hebrew for a person whose presence makes princes or reign in his sight. The Parthian Surin did exactly what the Hebrew word signifies, showing the parallels between the Hebrew and the Parthian language, and that they were no coincidence. Now, would the strong linguistic relationship between Hebrew and Parthian exist if the Parthians had a Mongoloid origin from the interior of Asia? Obviously, the answer is no. However, linguistic links to the Hebrew language as found among the Parthians are exactly what we should find among the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel who were displaced to Asia. Later, we're going to see that many of the personal and place names of the Parthians were not merely Semitic, but specifically Israelite in nature. After Parthia's empire fell, Parthia was ruled by the Greeks under Alexander the Great. When Alexander's kingdom was divided after his untimely death, Parthia was placed in the Seleucid Greek Empire. And there was an apparent fulfillment of an obscure biblical prophecy about the house of Israel, the 10 tribes, at the time that Alexander the Great destroyed the Persian Empire. We see in Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 3 through 5, an unusual prophecy is found in which God instructs Ezekiel to do the following. He said, "This shall be a sign to the house of Israel." He said, "Lie upon your left side, and then lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of the days you shall lie upon it, you shall bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days, so shall you bear the iniquity of the house of Israel." Well, for centuries, the Parthians had been captives of the Assyrians, Medes, and the Persians. The Israelite kingdom ended when Samaria fell in 721 B.C. The kingdom of Israel was the house of Israel, the northern 10 tribes. So if a 390-year punishment began at the fall of Samaria, a singular event should occur in the year 331 B.C., 721 B.C. minus 390 years equals 331 B.C., and it was in that year one of history's major turning points occurred, and it released the Israelites from their centuries of captivity. And it was also preceded in biblical prophecy, or predicted or prophesied in biblical prophecy, in Daniel 8, verses 5 through 22, where it prophesied that a great Grecian king would destroy the Medo-Persian Empire and that four kingdoms would replace his empire. It was Alexander the Great who fulfilled this prophecy. All right, we're covering a book here called Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, written by Stephen M. Collins. I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to drop it right there. I'll put my bookmark right in here, and we'll take this up next time. Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower. You can get a copy from BibleBlessings.net. Just go to BibleBlessings.net. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. And The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule of archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, we're just about out of time. There's the signal. It says my time is up. I'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.